This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So the area near Chewon, which is in the center of the Korean Peninsula, was the place of the fiercest fights in the Korean War. The city of Chewon has totally disappeared. It was quite a large city, almost as big as Seoul. And now it's a very idyllic landscape. There's a lot of military there, but you hardly see it. There are all sorts of tourist spots, like the so-called Peace Observatory, where you would actually watch DMZ. You don't see much. You see an invisible enemy. You see a natural paradise, like the one in our back here. And yet there's a particular fascination. And it's something that I remember, for instance, from the situation in Germany before 1989. Probably the most interesting building or monument and tourist spot in Germany was the Berlin Wall. And I think today one of the problems of Berlin is that, in a touristic perception, is that the wall has gone.
It's its biggest attraction.
Yeah. So I think this was not very smart, probably, on long term. At least Rome has preserved its Colosseum, which also was not a nice topic either. Yeah. And I think in that respect, some of the works deal quite specifically with this problem of perception, like the video by Mark Lewis, which is a very long shot on top of a hill that works a little bit like a panopticon within this landscape. And it also shows at the end of the video a tourist group watching, well, it's not quite clear what they actually see or expect to see. Tom,
what are we not seeing here? What got left behind? Because this is, all the work here seems very documentary and realistic to a certain extent, and I presume some of the things you left behind were a bit more, whatever, figurative.
Yeah, some of the work, for instance, you see the sketch, right when you enter, you see a sketch of a binocular, and it's a work by Thomas Saraceno, a site-specific work that is installed on the top of a hill it's a big building called Peace Observatory, assuming that could actually perceive peace. I don't know how you do that, but let's assume it's possible. It's probably the absence of war.
Nothing happening.
Yeah, which you could define as peace. And this work is site-specific, so he changed the geometry and the mode of perception of one binocular, one of ten. And he turned it into a 360-degree optical instrument that could also turn vis-à-vis the audience.
Back towards South Korea.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so this is a work that we left behind. It's just one example. Then the work you see here, these three photographs, or it's a processed photo in each case. It's a sound installation by Florian Hecker in an atomic bunker. So every village in Korea, in South Korea, is obliged by law to have a bunker. Since two or three years ago, some missiles from North Korea landed on South Korean territory. And so in all of these cases, these are just two examples, we were looking together with the artists for particular locations in this buffer zone. And since you mentioned the notion of the documentary, some of the works are indeed more what you could call documentary. Others, like for instance the sound file that you can listen over there by Ingo Niermann, it's part of a fiction. It's a work that's called Demechanized Zone, not demilitarized, but demechanized. And it's the first chapter of a book that he's writing within his book series that he is editing at Sternberg Press. It's called Solution, and it provides or invents solution for different countries or zones like Palestine, for instance, or there was another one in the U.S. And he asked a tour guide on a bus to read the first chapter of his book, which basically makes a reference to a situation in Germany, because as a German you cannot travel to Korea without being asked, well, how did you do the reunification? Assuming that you are a specialist for reunification and ignoring the fact that certain or the biggest historic facts probably happened by mistake. And so this is part of a more fictionalized situation. So this is something that is quite apparent in the show, that the documentary is already, in many cases, already part of a totally fictionalized situation. And we are producing a more extreme case, which is a work by Adrián Villarrojas, the Argentinian artist who has actually spent with his team a whole month in one of these propaganda villages. And he's preparing a film that is maybe at first glimpse a documentary, but he involves the inhabitants of that village in scenes that are totally fictionalized in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think to a certain extent this whole area close to the DMZ also feels a bit like a fiction, yeah, because mm-hmm. you also make up your enemy to a certain extent.
So it's and you were saying it's both a natural paradise, but somehow a completely artificially constructed natural paradise. It's a non-naturally occurring nature preserve.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So thanks to massive quantities of landmines and
exactly.
Yeah.
So the landmines are a trigger for nature.
Uh huh.
Because it actually keeps humans out of the area.
A value, yeah. So what's I got interested recently in the in trying to think about what other meanings of the notion of documentary there might be besides the kind of standard commonsensical one of a realistic representation. And I went back to the dictionary and learned or reminded myself that the etymology of documentary is from the Latin word docere, like a docent in a museum or a gallery. And a document is something instructive. A document's primary meaning is as a pedagogical device, a persuasive teaching device. And the beautiful example in the OED is of a tortured prisoner exposed in public. And I forget the exact phrase, but the idea is the prisoner feels the punishment, but let him be a document for others. So the document is a teaching device. And I was wondering, as I was looking at some of the work here, what sort of instruction was going on In these documents, and that it made me realize that I know nothing about Korea, but it made me realize in particular that I didn't quite know what was at stake politically in the DMZ, whether it was a former Cold War-ish geopolitical conflict which wasn't anymore and had been reduced to kind of a local dispute, or whether there was still an interesting geopolitical layer there. And then maybe there were other ways of framing the political question, which the work might want to be intervening in, that sort of sets the geopolitics or the lack of geopolitics aside and asks different questions, whether it's about nature or memory or whatever. Is there any way easily to summarize the contemporary political stakes of the DMZ?
Probably not easy, because it's so everything seems to be covered by propaganda in a way. Uh-huh. But as far as I understood, there people are still, for good reasons, afraid that something could happen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but
people so on both still, sides.
In a strange way, you could probably define this as one of the last relics of the Cold War, because it's still somehow a kind of heritage of that old opposition, mm-hmm. Which we all thought it's kind of overcome. And there are huge armies
facing each other.
So it's according to some statistics, it's still the most militarized zone on Earth, uh-huh. which could mean that maybe by accident or by some kind of mistake, a huge war could start. And it's of course a situation that might seem a bit schizophrenic if you know Seoul a little bit. For most people, this is very far away,
uh-huh.
and it's of course all young Korean men serve in the army for 2 years. I think it's quite a long time, and so it's still the military is still part of a reality there, and Seoul is. Probably 30 kilometers away from the border. So there is, you could argue that there is a threat. On the other hand, it seems to be very unreal. it's still part of political rhetorics, for instance, in the US, as a real problem. So there are. As with Tehran, there are talks with Pyongyang about nuclear
weapons.
And so, in that sense, of course, one tends to not take it seriously because it's also so absent. You don't mm-hmm. see it,
mm-hmm.
and you somehow very often describe it as sheer propaganda,
right.
But there is a geopolitical question, and there is somehow in the air, theoretically speaking, one day there might be reunification, which is another mm-hmm. geopolitical question.
Yeah. So in that sense, it is very much like the Cold War, a compressed version of the Cold War, where the enemies are. As much projections of the other side, where the weapons are hard to find. The front line is defined, but beyond that, it's difficult to say what there is. Do the works engage with that kind of normal understanding of politics, or are they trying to geopolitics, or are they trying to reframe it?
They're trying to reframe it and trying to, like for instance, Mark Lewis's work, it's showing military infrastructure, because the hill that you see there,
right. It's like a huge bunker or something?
It's a huge bunker.
Yeah, and, that's that one, right?
That's that one. Yeah. You see some entries into the bunker. In the other video that you see at the storefront, you would actually see the bunkers, which is a kind of second version of the same video, which was that we couldn't show actually in the buffer zone because of, for military reasons in a way.
You're giving away secrets?
Yeah, well, it's very secret. But it shows that in a way there is a permanent, when you work in a buffer zone, every artist also, or some of the artists also had to deal somehow with certain restrictions. Uh-huh. So you go, for instance, into the buffer zone, but you have to leave in the evening by sunset, uh-huh. which also restricts a little bit what you can do at work.
And the authorities could control what you made or shown?
They can. Uh-huh. But they are very cooperative, but you could also ask yourself, why are they cooperative? Being uh-huh. in a Cold War, uh-huh. And this is the slightly obscene contradiction between military, really high presence of military, uh-huh. on one hand, and on the other hand, an interest in tourism.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that for me was quite interesting to see, and I guess also for most of the artists, that working in that context is probably at first view something very loaded in a political sense. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you somehow enter a very fictionalized space as well.
Right. But tourism isn't necessarily a negative word there, right? It's a description of a certain relation to reality as which acknowledges its somewhat unreal nature. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's related. Actually, I think it's fun how the photo opportunity sequence. So there's a lot of pictures of the president of North Korea in various poses, is juxtaposed with the Mark Lewis piece, which pulls back to show us all the tourists looking. So there's something like an analogy of photo opportunities there. Yeah. What we're seeing there is a photo opportunity, but it's nice because the Kim Jong-il photo ops remind you that even though they're completely staged and utterly artificial and 100% fake and are happening only in order to have their picture taken, that's actually one way in which political activity takes place, that those are political gestures, that they're moves in a game of power. And so when you would be tempted to sort of dismiss them as merely fake or just photo opportunities or pure simulacra or something like that, but it turns out that there are a lot of political stakes in simulacra.
Yeah.
And so then I think it's interesting to run that back through the question of tourism, because I think often there's, this is why I asked whether it was a bad word, often it is. Often it's a word that has a little bit of derision or dismissal in it, like your relation to that is purely touristic, meaning you're not taking it seriously, or you're just there, you think you're seeing reality, but the reality that's presented to tourists is a artificially produced one, and so on. It seems to me that there are serious things at stake in tourism, whether it's of the DMZ kind or the presidential photo op kind. And it reminded me of these this discourse that emerged. Kind of it's a post-Cold War discourse, which worries somehow that the wars of the 90s and the 2000s, the wars after 89, were somehow not, they weren't as real as good old wars used to be. Mm. That they were TV wars, or they were CNN wars, or they were Twitter wars, or whatever. And all those adjectives indicate kind of the colonization of reality by the image or by representation in a way that seems to make it less weighty or less serious. And I was reminded of the, we were talking before about this project that Liz Diller and Rick Scofidio did in the early 90s in Normandy about tourists revisiting the battlefields of the Second World War. And I got interested in the notion that even real battlefields where people were shooting at each other and so on, were starting to look in the 90s more like sites that tourists would visit. So people, the surgeon is here, people often said about Sarajevo that the peacekeepers and the NGO workers and the humanitarians and the reporters all seem to be visiting the frontline battle zone as if they were on a safari, as if they were just there to take pictures, that they were just observing and not doing anything, as if the presence of all those tourists wasn't actually a major factor in the way the battle in Sarajevo unfolded. But it was a good lesson in how words like tourism or photo opportunity and other, you know, maligned institutions are playing major roles in politics and in conflict, and need to be taken seriously. Yeah. It seems to me you walked right into one of those here.
you wrote that text for the Diller Scofidio work, or in relation to it, on the conflict in Somalia.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was interested there in how, so I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember, but in 91-92, there was technically the second, because the first one was in Kurdistan after the first Gulf War, but really the first well-publicized humanitarian intervention. 20-something thousand American and other soldiers went to Somalia, ostensibly not to take sides, but only to feed the starving people caught up in between the warring factions of the civil war. And in December 91, the U.S. Marine Special Forces landed on the beach in Mogadishu in a kind of a top secret, middle of the night reconnaissance mission. And they were met, like the 30 guys who landed in the little rubber boats on the beach were met by 300 reporters and television cameras and sound crews and big lights and so on, because it was a military photo opportunity. It was a chance to demonstrate what the new role for the American military was going to be in the aftermath, and precisely because the Cold War was over. And that seemed, I think, the public response to that was that it was kind of weird and awkward and fake, and that the army shouldn't be, the serious military should not be engaged in this kind of staged operation, which felt to me like it ignored the fact that, you know, the battle for public opinion and the battle to take over the television screen or the front page of the newspaper is as old as fighting wars, you know, are too. So again, to like really think, to try to think seriously about the political role of these, political military role of these simulacra. And you know, it ended, that intervention ended in a kind of weird and perverse reversal of the way it had started, with the American army getting ejected from Somalia because one of its special forces guys, many of its special forces guys, had been killed by Somali militants, and one of them had his body dragged through the streets of the city with a television camera watching it. So start with a photo opportunity, end with a photo opportunity, and if the first one looked a bit pathetic, the second one looked super tragic, and in a weird way won the war. Mm. So, but they both were, you know, had this edge on them of a touristic spectatorship, mm. Which I think left some people feeling a bit weird.
Yeah.
I don't know, but this seems like serious tourism you found here.
Yeah, there's tourism around the DMZ is really seen as an opportunity to an economic opportunity for regions that are very much at the border. So there's not much industry. The income is rather low. The population is very old, mm-hmm. an aging population. So it seems to be an area without really a future. It's very much at the edge. And
it's the same on the other side?
It's the same on the other side because they're too close to the border.
Uh-huh.
There's some exceptions, like a special economic zone, which is operated by South Korean companies, but it's basically collaborating with North Korean workers uh-huh. and the party. But in general, tourism is seen as an opportunity. And at the same time, there's tourism always comes across with a certain ideology. Tourism in this area is always, or in most cases, literally a tour, a guided tour. So the tour guide and the words spoken out by the tour guide are it's a particular story that is provided mm-hmm. on the bus.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it has very often something very theatrical in the way these tour buses or these tours are organized. For instance, when we talk about there's something totally contradictory in a way. There's everybody who goes to the DMZ is totally fascinated by the border. So you look coming from the south, it's very obvious that the main thing is actually watching in the north.
The other side. Yeah.
Watching is fine, but you are actually not allowed to take photographs
uh-huh.
because the South Korean authorities are afraid of some photographs used by North Korean spies. And so... So they are afraid that some of the fortifications or military infrastructures uh-huh. are actually shown. So therefore, you will not find a single photograph looking northwards.
Uh-huh.
Although illegally, tourists.
Yeah, I read that there were YouTube videos or Flickr photos, and then they're quickly, as soon as the authorities find out about them, they disappear. Yeah.
Uh-huh. For instance, the photo that the Sloat Foundation used to on the website, I think, with Thomas uh-huh. Saraceno's photo, this is, well, strictly speaking, this
you're
totally,
going to be in trouble.
I think you're... borderline. So we actually had to negotiate this also with the military, what's possible, what's mm-hmm. not possible in terms of imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, there are lots of contradictions. There's a fascination with a particular view, but you are not allowed to take a picture.
Uh-huh. So that's counter-touristic.
It's counter-touristic, yeah. and also the when you listen to a tour guide, they're of course super experienced because there are thousands of tourists coming to the border, And they, for instance, always refer, that's why it's interesting to look at the media selection that you proposed for this exhibition here. They always talk about the dictator. They never mention the name.
Uh-huh.
But there's a constant reference to the dictator. So you actually look at a landscape that is quite empty,
uh-huh.
but I think most people actually see those images in their mind, like uh-huh. because these are the images that you would see uh-huh. on TV.
And does it look the same? Can you tell that there's a difference between the one side of the border and the other?
I can't, because I wasn't in North Korea so far. But one of the...
No, but you can see across the border, or not?
Yeah, you can. And there are similar procedures, in a way. So there are also bus tours from the north, starting in Pyongyang, to the DMZ, mm-hmm. but just from northern direction. So this was very much the idea of the project that Ingo Niermann started. So his trip to Korea actually started in the north. So he did a DMZ tour starting from Pyongyang, going to the DMZ, then doing the same thing from the other side. Of course, you cannot go directly from Pyongyang to Seoul. You have to go through Beijing. So in that sense, also, foreigners are a bit privileged. They can go to mm-hmm. both sides. Okyong, for instance, for you, would be impossible to go to North Korea.
Yeah. Do you know what the narrative in the bus on the North Korean side is?
Well, I can now only refer to Ingo Niermann, who told me that actually the bus tour in the north was a bit more gentle. But what does it mean? He said that they were a bit more relaxed, but maybe more relaxed in their language,
mm-hmm.
but maybe just because most tourists probably behave more properly in the north
uh-huh.
and don't make many jokes.
They're better trained.
Uh-huh. And but I remember the one bus tour in the south where, for instance, taking photographs of the border, the tour guides are really afraid that the tourists uh-huh. Basically fuck up the tour, yeah, by taking pictures. And they might lose their jobs or whatever, or might produce problems with the military. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there's very often a certain tension during these tours.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't happen because no one would dare do that on the North Korean bus, or?
Probably not so much, mm-hmm. but that's an assumption. uh-huh. I don't know it. But I think that there's an interesting relationship when it comes to the images that are produced in these conflict zones,
mm-hmm. and,
or generally the images produced on conflicts. And you have also worked very intensely on that question. I remember the exhibition Photojournalism,
uh-huh.
which.
Anti-photojournalism,
sorry. And which also raised this question, what is at stake here when we talk about political images, images of conflict, to what extent is it a documentary practice?
Right.
To what extent is it kind of creation of a new reality,
right.
and to me this is in such an area like the inner Korean border zone, It's an interesting question because we somehow, as a visitor, we somehow assume now, maybe because of the German example and maybe of other examples as well, we somehow assume that this will change. It might take decades or centuries. Yet it also triggers a certain imagination.
Yeah.
And therefore, there is, of course, a certain respect vis-à-vis those political conflicts. On the other hand, I wonder to what extent this can be fictionalized, or we artists or photographers or cinematographers could, to what extent can they actually speculate or trigger new images?
Why couldn't they?
I think they can, but I wonder a bit how close should they stay to the what we could call the political reality.
Yeah, I guess that's part of the reason why I was asking what you thought was at stake politically in this space. It's strange how, like, when you think about it as an image making problem, there's such a good long history or longish history of documentary photography of conflict, whether it's of battlefields or uprisings or social conflict or difference. Which seems to have gone through various chapters or phases with differing relations of different understandings of what the how an image grasps the reality that it tries to present. From sort of the magnum tradition of photojournalists who went off to the war or to the ghetto or whatever to document and expose the otherwise hidden or invisible realities. That doesn't seem like really what's going on here. It feels like the reality is pretty highly exposed, with the exception of the little secret things which you can't take pictures of. But. Yeah. And then maybe there's another phase certainly in conflict photography, where the participants or the protagonists in the conflict seem to have become more aware or hyper aware of the role that images can play in the way the conflict unfolds, so they understand the force of the exposé or of the action image. And so they try to control it in some way or other, whether it's either by censoring it or by working more closely with reporters or photographers or people with cameras, so embedded journalism of one sort or another, whether it's just somebody traveling with a platoon or the actual formal legal process of embedding. And then it seems like there's another phase which happens when protagonists in conflict don't even need other people with cameras anymore because they have their own cameras and they have access to means of distributing and making available their own images of war. And somehow it feels like we're living in a world in which those forces are still kind of overlapping and competing with each other in different ways. That's why I was really interested in I was reading somewhere that some South Korean soldiers had been disciplined for taking and making available their own pictures of this particular conflict zone. But then also the idea that there is so much organized photographic behavior here, that people are going there in order to take pictures as well. And it's still a conflict zone in which I presume photojournalists are at work, whether they're covering the ironies, like all the bunny rabbits and so on, or the face-off. Seems like you have traces of all of that here.
Yeah, you have all that, and you have, of course, also cameras within the DMZ.
The military devices.
Military devices that are, well, that have been implemented in order to control maybe the enemy soldiers, but at the same time they also record animals.
Uh-huh.
So there are, of course, in parallel, many other motivations.
Right.
Or many other
Have you
other
seen
agendas.
Those images? Are they viewable?
This is something we are trying because if you really try to get these images, it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. So we are trying actually one project. It was an idea we had developed with together with Terence Simon. Mm-hmm. And her first idea was actually to get this
to
material.
Go to the archive.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because there seems to be from the South Korean side, there seems to be, with the help of the U.S. military actually, there seems to be something like a grid that every 100 meter over the 250 kilometers of the uh-huh. border, there is a camera.
It's recording?
It's uh-huh. recording, uh-huh. yeah. So you have... And you might not see many soldiers, you might see amazing animals. And this is maybe another parallel story which is shown in this film, for instance, mm-hmm. That there's an assumption of a better life somehow, created by the atrocities of the war and mm-hmm. frozen line between two enemies, that there's a happy life.
The better life is
there.
Is the animals?
There. Yeah. I think that there's an assumption.
The allegory of the good life?
Uh-huh. I think this is a bit what
That's great.
Humans, again, project on this zone,
uh-huh.
Which is slightly perverse either. Yeah. And there are amazing histories also that
That's
are
fantastic.
Slightly fictional. There's a rumor of a tiger there. It's a bit like in the Himalaya, it's the Yeti. Uh-huh. In Scotland, it's Loch Ness.
Uh-huh.
Here, there's apparently a white tiger. Nobody has ever seen, or there's no real proof of that animal, but it's kind of emblem of this natural paradise.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I think this is there's a particular imagery developed around nature,
mm-hmm.
and this is also in the back of the political agenda right now, implemented very much by the new president, conservative President Park, daughter of the South Korean dictator Park, mm-hmm. from the 1960s. There's now a competition on a so-called peace park. Which is meant to be installed somewhere along the border, and there are different regions now competing for this peace park because it's a major infrastructural project,
mm-hmm.
and it's. I think that there's a whole history about borders, and obviously, and it's also about. State money invested
right.
in border areas,
mm-hmm.
and since we are also in we talk about a context in the art world, the best one of the best example of border politics is the Documenta in Kassel. Yeah, it's, mm-hmm. The main reason to implement this in Kassel was that it was very close to the border,
uh-huh.
and it was very poor. There was no economy. It was destroyed. Art was meant to play a role as a propaganda tool, for Western culture, and it was
and
also
economic
meant
development.
To also be a touristic place.
Right.
And this is, I think, also an interesting relationship between art projects and politics and conflict. And this is, of course, one of the contradictions when you do such a project. And artists feel that contradiction. Mm-hmm. And I hope that some of the projects also
push back a little.
Yeah, I think they actually, most of the artists really reflected that slightly uncomfortable situation.
Yeah. The Peace Park, there will be lots of animals in the Peace Park. I'm excited about this idea that the animals are the future. They're the signifiers of the of a Pacific life together.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's great.
And the best example are, of course, the birds, because
The border.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The airspace is slightly has a totally different logic.
Yeah. Our heroes.
Yeah. I was told by Aaron that
should we stop
should
and
probably
are people allowed to talk, or are we going to go right to the performance?